you want to know more about Ariana Grande's resume, go to IMDb.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I have to say. You're listening to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
Peter, we're now up to date on the career of Ariana Grande and where she began.
Oh, yeah, up to date.
And we're not talking about her in the news today, but...
we'll see. No, I'm kidding.
We'll see what happens in the breaking news section.
She's everywhere, who knows?
That's very true. Also everywhere is Netflix, and we'll get to that in a second. Mm-hmm. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the news movies, which this week will be the new autobiographical drama Roma, which is now streaming on Netflix. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including the box office. It turns out that movies with women in the lead do better than ones with men in the lead, and who knew? Then, 25 new films have been added to the National Film Registry in the Library of Congress. We'll talk about this year's picks. And then finally, have we gotten a sneak peek inside the relatively bland production process of Marvel Studios thanks to the perspective of a prospective Black Widow director, I should say. But first, we got to go back to award show mayhem. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's mayhem. So the Oscars still don't have a host. And there was another major award nominations list announced last week. And
but not the confirmed noms, right?
The SAG nominations.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I thought we were talking about the Academy.
That won't be till January, I think. But, you know, the Oscar host drama is interesting because we talked about it on last week's show. Kevin Hart was the host, and then he wasn't the host.
Yeah, deserve it for him. Deserved.
Deserved that he was the host or deserved that
deserved that he left. Well, what would have been deserved is he was kicked off. But yeah, he left. So that I think that was the right choice.
But I think what's interesting is that...
no apology.
Well, he did apologize after. He quit with no apology and then somebody
did
said
after?
Like...
Okay.
You have to apologize.
All right.
Yeah.
His agent probably.
Probably everyone who has any advice they would offer him about anything show business related.
I was already surprised he was hosting it anyways, right? Mm-hmm. Like Golden Globe, that would make sense. MTV Awards, that would make sense. Oscars, Kevin Hart? I'm not against his acting or anything, but it does not really
Golden
fit in
Globes,
with the Oscars.
Max. Is it because of his comedy?
Yeah, he's just in comedies. He hasn't been in anything that would, I ever think, get nominated for an Oscar.
Well, that's not like a... A requirement.
Yeah, I guess, but but see, other people that they're not in movies, but like Jimmy Kimmel, right? Like mm-hmm. they're immersed in culture enough, and like they interview enough people who are movie stars that I think he has more connection
right
to the Oscars.
Well, I would point out Jimmy Kimmel was also the premier late night host of the network that hosts the Oscars,
mm-hmm.
so that makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, I don't know. Kevin Hart just didn't feel right.
Okay, well, fair enough. I think what's interesting, though, is that it's been over a week since he was announced, and then he resigned, and then there's, like, been no...
Drama.
Yeah, no, this is, like, the most interesting drama seems to be about hosting the Oscars themselves. Like, they haven't announced a replacement, which speaks to, at least to me, that...
Billy Crystal. It'd be, like, his 14th time.
Is it 14?
I don't know. It'd be a double digit.
I think it would be his 10th. I think he's done 9. This would be his 10th. But I think he's like kind of sworn off it.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's basically no plan B, which I find astonishing.
Like, I think in 1956, and I believe 63, there was also no host, right?
Mm-hmm.
This wouldn't be the first time. So I don't know. That'd be interesting.
Well, famously, the last time there was no host for the Oscars was 1988, which opened with the dance between Rob Lowe and Snow White.
Yeah, that was enjoyable.
Was
I've
it?
Seen it on YouTube. It was enjoyable, but in a comedic way. So I could see if it did not go with the Oscar flow that it needed to have.
I think it did not go with the Oscar flow, which is why I don't think I've seen Rob Lowe at the Oscars mm-hmm. ever since, or Snow White for that matter. but I mean, I think this speaks to this Hollywood Reporter article mm-hmm. that came out at the beginning of the month that said that it's like the least wanted job in Hollywood. It's like the Hollywood equivalent of White House Chief of Staff.
Yeah, the pay is nothing. Like
no,
nothing
it's
at all.
That's true. That you don't get paid very much for it.
No.
It requires a lot of time, effort, and energy to get prepared. There's a lot of scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to work with writers who may not necessarily be to your humor. Mm-hmm. If you're someone like, you know, they let somebody like Chris Rock or Jon Stewart bring a couple of people in to help them craft, you know, the jokes to their voice.
Okay, but, well, that was smart.
But yeah, but by and large, it's like the same crew of people who are coming up with these like canned laughs and who can we?
Yeah, probably the same writers they've had since the 80s. Who knows, right? You know, probably like, still just Rob Reiner doing it all, right? He's up to something.
Rob Reiner's up to something?
I don't know.
That's a bold statement.
I also just want to say that Nick Kroll, John Mulaney thing was, that was rude. Like, I love them, and that was exciting at first, but I thought it was the truth. I genuinely thought they were going to be hosting the Oscars. So, and Tom Green posted last night he's going to be doing the Oscars. So now everyone's just joking about it, and it's just, it's all over the place.
It's, yeah, I mean, well, the same thing about, I mean, it's a weird comparison, but, you know, White House Chief of Staff, that, you know, it should be a position everybody wants that nobody wants.
Well, especially right now, right?
Well, I think we know why you would want to be White House Chief of Staff, but I think it's a bigger sort of question about why you wouldn't want to be an Oscar host.
The views are going down, too.
The views are going down,
which is for like the last, you know, like a decade.
Right, which is another part of the problem, which is something that, you know, Kevin Hart might resolve if he had, because Kevin Hart brings in a new generation.
And that was probably the reasoning, for picking him. That makes sense.
But I wrote this down. Somebody said something insightful. Like, I can't remember who exactly it was, but they said, you know, the Oscars want to flirt with edginess, but they don't want to be controversial. Which, you know, if you're going to hire somebody like Kevin Hart, first of all, we talked about last week about how the scrubbing of the Twitter feed should have been done before the announcement. But second of all,
why didn't he do that? What were you doing?
But the second piece of that, though, is why don't we just sort of accept it as a fact that, you know, given that social media is, you know, almost 15, actually probably is 15 years old from when Facebook was first encoded, people have lived their entire, you know, people old enough to have lived their entire lives on Facebook, and to be of a certain age when they might, you know, whether that's people in IRL who are just, you know, going at job interview, you know, you can Google somebody and find something stupid they said on Instagram 5 years ago when they were 15. But this is something in all walks of life that has to be rectified, that, you know, at some point all of us have said something stupid on Twitter.
Well, and especially people like Kevin Hart and James Gunn, right?
Yeah, it's a, yeah.
And they have people that work for them, too, that could go through their Twitters.
Yeah.
And get rid of things, so.
Well, not even just get rid of things, but, you know, come to peace with the idea that people have said stupid things, and because Twitter enshrines them and the internet is forever, you know, these things can be easily found. Even if you do scrub your Twitter account, who knows, like, someone has, like, screenshots of stuff.
That's true.
Or the
That's
Internet
true.
Archive or things like that.
Yeah, like, Twitter has their own archive, right? Like,
sure.
There's probably so many people, you know, hackers in Russia and stuff, or just anywhere that can go in there and find it.
Right.
Actually, that might have been what happened to James Gunn. I think he actually had deleted it, possibly.
He might have.
Yeah.
He might have. But, I mean, that was like the Kevin Hart case. Kevin Hart had to address this before. James Gunn had also had to address his tweets from before, too. So it's like these incidents aren't surprising because, you know, it's all happened before. But I also want to talk about the SAG nominations because that's another sort of Oscar indicator. And there were no major nominations for any of the Netflix titles. So, like, Netflix had a lot of the major, what are considered the major players. So things like Roma, things like The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Bird Box, which comes out next week on Netflix, which stars Sandra Bullock. It's kind of like a post-apocalyptic drama that she's getting a lot of buzz for.
Okay, good.
But there's also none for First Man. Again, Ryan, we talked about this last week about the Golden Globe nominations. Ryan Gosling as the first man on the moon should have been a
Not
slam
deserved,
dunk.
Yeah. I think you said it should have been a slam dunk.
It should have been a slam. Like, that seems like a pro forma thing. Like, Ryan Gosling could have sleptwalked through it.
Yeah, and still gotten a
nomination. And still got a nomination.
Yeah. So it didn't get any nominations for the SAG?
I don't think it got for the SAG, no. First Reformed was also snubbed, which has gotten not a, a big movie, but it's gotten a lot of buzz, especially for Ethan Hawke in it. If Beale Street Could Talk, no nominations. No nominations for Widows, which we were talking about before the show, which...
Yeah, playing right now in Guelph. Y'all should see it.
Yeah, it's at the bookshelf. No nominations for Eighth Grade, which is another one of those.
That's baloney. The Eighth Grade was really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally not a biased opinion on my part, but that's the one that's baloney.
But I was pleased to see that there was Best Ensemble, which is the SAG nomination for Best Picture, for BlacKkKlansman, which I thought had a great ensemble, and Crazy Rich Asians, which was another great ensemble.
That was a fantastic ensemble.
Although it's still BS that Michelle Yeoh doesn't get Best Supporting for
the mother. Is she the one who plays the mother?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then
she was pretty main character, too. I wouldn't mind her just getting the main character award. All the awards.
I'm not sure I would disagree, but I mean, I think the...
No, she is a supporting.
Yeah, it's a supporting role. But I think she definitely deserves... I hope the Oscars will reconsider. And the other interesting thing was Emily Blunt gets two nominations, Best Actress for Mary Poppins and Best Supporting Actress for A Quiet Place.
Oh, for I don't know about that one, but I haven't seen Mary Poppins yet, so.
Well, it doesn't technically come out till Wednesday.
Yeah, I know.
Or till today.
Yeah, I always find it strange when they nom things that, because
because we record
in
advance.
We'll see how it goes. I love the first one.
First Mary Poppins?
Yeah, I don't know.
So many unanswered questions.
I don't know if Hamilton has it in him to replace Dick Van Dyke. I don't know. I'll find out.
All right. Stay tuned.
It's Paul Stanley.
CAA, which is a talent agency, did a poll. They crunched the numbers for movies between 2014 and 2017 and found out that movies that had a woman as the top build did better than movies with a man as the top build, which also goes part and parcel with their study last year that shows that movies with a more diverse cast do better than movies with less diverse cast. It's almost weird how that works out.
Yeah. Well, in the article, it's more a ratio thing, right?
Yeah.
Those films are getting so much less budget.
Right.
And that is the only reason, in comparison to the budget, it does seem like the actresses are getting way more pay, right?
Right.
Yeah. Whereas I think in a film with, I forget what the example was, but there was one where the budget was just $10 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the main actress got paid a ton. But I think if an actor, male actor, that was as famous as her was in a film that was also $10 million, he would get even more than that, right?
Sure.
Whereas his film would be $100 million. His film would be $50 million, right?
Right. That's the thing is that they mention... It's purely based on who's the top build.
Yeah.
If it's a female or if it's a male. Because something like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, for example, which technically Megan Fox is
the
top build.
She better get paid the most, yeah.
But it's you would be crazy to say that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is about April O'Neil. It's not April O'Neil, it's about the four mutant turtles.
Yeah.
But it also includes something like... what was that movie that came out with Saoirse Ronan last year? Lady Bird, which is one of those like micro-budget things you're talking about, which is...
Yeah, and in that one, there was no like male character really at all.
Right,
well, but small characters, but...
Right. But, it also...
If she had a father that was more present and it was an A-list, I think he'd probably get as much or ratio-wise as much as them.
Right. And the other thing was that that movies that passed the Bechdel test, apparently we're seeing more and more of those, and the Bechdel test is a movie where there are two named female characters who talk to each other, and that conversation is not about a man.
Oh, I've heard about that.
So
yeah.
It's like literally, it's literally the least a movie could do.
Yeah.
Because it's... there are a lot of great movies that that don't pass the Bechdel test, and one of them from this year is like Mission Impossible Fallout, which a lot of people say is like a really great movie. It also has a very strong female character,
yeah, it does.
And Ilsa Faust, but there is only one other female. No, there are two other named female characters. No, there are three other because there's the arms dealer, there's Ethan Hunt's ex-wife, and then there's Angela Bassett as the head of the CIA, but none of those women ever talk to each other.
No, they have such a small amount of lines, too.
So it's, I mean, these things are interesting. I think it's something to keep in mind, too, that apparently 52% of the movie-going audience is female.
See, that makes sense to me. That I totally understand that. I go to see movies the most with my mom and my aunts, so. Although my dad does love films. He teaches it here, UG. But, yeah, no, it's...
He's been disenfranchised by the whole thing after years of kids
another,
here.
another theory.
Yeah.
Average lifespan for females, way higher, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I see, you know, you see a matinee. There's so many seniors there. So that, I think, also is part of the reason why there is more women seeing films.
Well, there's also the strollers and stars things, like that the Cineplex does. Where,
you're right. Yep. So,
yeah.
And still, by average, there is, you know, more stay-at-home moms than dads. So that makes sense, too. That would raise up the average.
Right. There's more moms who are spending the days with the kids. Yeah. Interesting. This is also interesting. The National Film Registry for the last 30 years has chosen 25 films to be preserved for all time. This year, they chose 25 more. Among them are some fairly well-known ones, like Jurassic Park and The Shining, to name two. Also, Cinderella, which is, I think, the ninth animated film.
Just the ninth?
Yeah. And they're all Disney, too.
Yeah, probably. Well, it took a while. Cinderella came out in the 50s, right?
1950s,
yeah. But Snow White is definitely on it, right?
Snow White was in the first batch.
Yeah, okay.
And I think they're working their way chronologically because Snow White is in it. Pinocchio 36. Is.
Yeah. It's in it, too? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, Fantasia.
And there was another one, Dumbo.
Oh, deserve it.
And then from the 90s, there's Beauty and the Beast, Toy Story, and The Lion King.
Okay.
So I don't know if they're working their way to
somewhere skipped, in the middle. They skipped a few. Yeah, what about Aristocats?
I think that was 70s.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They got
to
get
there. Lion King was 90s.
Right? No, I know, but...
Yeah. It is more special.
What about the three Caballeros? Anyway, so those are broadcast news is another sort of one that people might be familiar with that got included in terms of the well-known ones. Rebecca, Alfred Hitchcock's. Oh, Brokeback Mountain, too. That's right. I forgot about Brokeback. Yeah. Alfred Hitchcock's first movie, Rebecca.
And Buster Keaton's The Navigator.
Yeah.
I think 23, and it's... It's hilarious. Just if you like physical comedy, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And I think if you watch it, you will respect certain current actors and physical comedians more.
Yeah, no, it's
fun.
All that stuff is great. The General, of course, which is probably his most famous one, has been in there for forever. Out on the Town, or just On the Town with Frank Sinatra and Gene Kelly also is in it now. My Fair Lady is one that is now in the registry, too.
Yeah, surprised not sooner for that one.
Yeah, that is a bit surprising. The 11th film by John Ford is now in The Informer.
Cool.
Which I find he has 11 films, so I guess the point can be made he's sort of like the through person for American film. There are some lesser known things, including some like Smoke Signals, which was from the 90s, but it's a film that was made by Indigenous Americans.
Oh, well, that's fair then, yeah.
Starring Indigenous Americans. Mm-hmm. So it's a fairly unique entry. I think it was the first film to predominantly feature Indigenous, or at least first mainstream American film to predominantly feature Indigenous people by Indigenous people.
That's good. I'm glad the National Registry is doing that.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be spreading it out in a more proper way than the Oscars and SAG.
Yes.
Student Actors Guild noms. Yeah, I agree with all those. Be honest. What are your thoughts on Jurassic Park? Is it...
I think...
When it comes to CGI, it was pretty progressive.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the patient zero of CG.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can go back to young Sherlock Holmes with the stained glass knight. That was a CG creation.
But this made it like boom. This made
right.
It, like,
this has made it. Thing. Yeah. This has made it. This is what made it cheaper.
All right.
Or that it. You know. It's.
That's fair.
There are films in the registry that are there sort of for their technical merits, and films that are there for, like Birth of a Nation, for example. You probably wouldn't put Birth of a Nation in any movie collection if it weren't for the fact it was like the first feature length film ever made, because it's just it's so gross and racist. it's almost impossible to watch on that basis. But because it was the first feature length,
it deserves
film. It's part of the history. It's part of this, which is why I wish Disney would just take Song of the South out of the frickin' vault. Yes. It's problematic. It's racist. It's disturbing. But so is Dumbo with those freaking crows.
Yeah, Dumbo 100%. Yeah, I'm curious how they're going to go about that in the upcoming one.
Right, yeah, because I don't think there'll be any crows in it at all.
No.
But you're right, because you know there are details to that. And even going back to the Looney Tunes, I have a set of Looney Tunes cartoons on Blu-ray, and in it comes with like a warning. It's like, you know, some of these portrayals...
Really?
Back in the day, we're okay, and we sort of realize now it's not okay. But yeah, I was just released Song of the South.
Yeah, because it was special in a lot of other ways.
Also, Jerry Lewis is gone, so I hope they really. I can't remember the name of it. The movie he made where he's a clown during the Holocaust. It has to be seen.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. So
I think Harry Shearer saw. I don't know. I can't remember Harry Shearer's exact quote off the top of my head, but he's like basically it was like so incredibly off the mark.
Yeah.
It's like offensive in a way that is like truly unique. So, I mean, there are some options for the future.
Yeah, there is. There really is.
What I find interesting about the film registry, right before we sort of leave this topic, is they include like little like clips of like things, like Something Good, which is this clip from 1898, which is like probably the first instance of that shows black people being intimate. It was this like a film of like people kissing. Apparently, that used to be a thing, as they would film people kissing. Because I guess it was, you know, a quick, simple like, action that you could...
Like just random people kissing, or...?
I guess.
That's weird.
Well, I mean, this was 1898,
well,
and film was new and kooky.
It would be cheaper, too, right?
I mean, how much crazy things have people recorded with their cell phone because they can?
Yeah. No actors union or anything.
That's no, there were no actors unions yet. And then they had another one called The Dixon Windmaker Expedition to Crow. And it's basically like I guess somebody in Philadelphia was like making a documentary of what indigenous life looked like in Montana at the turn of the 20th century, and it was just kind of found randomly in a desk somewhere in 1982 in a Montana antique store.
That sounds interesting. That's being put into it at the same time as Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah.
It sounds like the kind of plot line where like Brokeback Mountain wouldn't be its style without that.
They went in search of. With a turn of the 20th century documentary about indigenous people. Different take. I'll never forget seeing Brokeback Mountain at the bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after it won Oscars and everything. And there's the first love scene between Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger, and somebody got up and left.
Oh, that's, yeah.
It's like,
mess off.
I didn't know there was gay sex in Brokeback Mountain.
Well, then they didn't even read, like, the poster. What are they doing?
It's crazy.
Yeah. I was really young when it came out, and I was seeing a different film in the theaters, but I went in to see my parents. And when I walked in, it was that scene. It was that scene. And I didn't run out. It didn't bother me. So, yeah, mess off to this guy.
Men kissing?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
I was just happy they were, you know, getting some love.
I take you didn't stay for the finale.
I have seen the full one that many times. Read the book, too. They're both just, yeah, great.
All right. Well, if we're done mocking Brokeback Mountain, there was an interview with Lucrecia Martel, who is an Argentine director. She's made several films, including The Headless Woman and Holy Girl. She had a film that came out this year called Zara. But she was one of the 65 female directors that Marvel Studios was looking at to make Black Widow. And she talked... in an interview about what that process looked like, where they just basically said to her, we're looking for a lady director. You don't have to worry about the action scenes. You just have to, like, make sure that...
Which is... Yeah, that's just a sexist statement itself. Yeah. That's... I love her reaction. I really do. She was just not okay with that.
Right. Well, why would she be?
Yeah.
But it's... what I find fascinating is, yeah, both the kind of sexism that's it's like ladies can't direct action, which is bollocks.
She made a statement in the article that we read that she loves making action scenes, right?
Right.
And if you want to make a good film, in her mind, like, she's used to indie ones, right? Like, she has to be a part of all of it for it to be the proper film that she wants to make.
Right. And that's the other side of this, too, is that it's a peek inside the Marvel machine. And it is a machine that they – if you look at the credits in the Marvel movies – you'll see a lot of the same names repeat themselves. And it's because it's
the ones directing the action scenes,
right? And you know, the stunt coordinators and the visual effects people. It's because, like, this is like very much sort of a machine. And I speak as someone who doesn't hate the Marvel movies. I think some of them are different in quality.
Yeah, I think some of them are great.
I wish Vince was here because he's
a huge fan, right?
No.
Oh no, he's super against them. Right. Yes.
Oh, Vince's head just exploded, besmirching his reputation as a hater. But no, that
I can see why he does.
Yeah, it just, you know, they've brought in a lot of interesting people, like Ryan Coogler, Taika Waititi, and you know, John Watt on the Spider-Man movies.
See, Evan Goldberg, though, right? He was the one directing the first Ant-Man, and then he left.
You mean Edgar Wright?
Edgar Wright, yes. Jeepers.
Although I would like to see Evan Goldberg.
Yeah. Yeah, and Edgar Wright. And then?
Starring Seth Rogen as Ant-Man.
Control.
Right.
And he left, right?
Yeah.
So it could be for the same reason. Either they didn't let him do the action, or they didn't let him do as much of the comedy as he wanted.
Right. But it's about, you know, where's the fine line between, you know, being creative, you know, using your own voice, adapting the character your way, and then fitting it in with the larger universe. And I think this is where DC is setting a more unique course, where it's like sort of learned the lesson of this, is that it seems like they are now sort of letting the creators
have way more control.
Have a bit more, yeah, because we have James Wan doing Aquaman. And that's, you know, that's
it
something.
Looks fun.
It looks like a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
And you see. In the trailer that eventually the Jason Momoa Aquaman gets like the proper Aquaman costume rather than this snidered up thing he was wearing in Justice League. Shazam 2 is another one.
The upcoming Shazam, yeah.
Yeah, where it looks like it's, you know, I think the guy who did Lights Out and Annabelle Creation is making that. So
DC is also fantastic at that when it comes to their TV shows.
Yes.
Supergirl. They give the directors for Supergirl just free control. Like, they get Kevin Smith. He's on, like, 8 episodes. They just let him do whatever he wants.
There was an episode of The Flash where him and Jason Mewes were playing security guards.
Exactly.
But, I mean, that is a good example.
A lot of female directors for Supergirl, too.
Yeah, including Lexi Alexander.
Exactly, yeah.
Who we talked about last week. But the DC shows are interesting because they all have sort of a unique voice. They all have different characters. They all kind of lead their own lives, and then occasionally they come together and have little crossover adventures too. But I mean, that could speak also to the greater flexibility in TV in terms of it's a bit harder to coordinate several different TV shows.
Mm-hmm. It'll all,
unless your name's Dick Wolf.
This whole what Marvel's doing might change when Disney, their website, right?
Oh, you mean the streaming
site? Yeah, the Disney streaming site. Who knows?
Well, I mean, we're reaching the end of the current slate, and we don't know what comes after Spider-Man next summer.
Yeah, also, if they do just give female directing roles and acting roles to the streaming site, then that itself, even though that's good, that's, you know, why do they get that and not the directing the films?
Yeah, that's dicey. But, you know, this would...
Marvel's just, when it comes to the women's role, Marvel needs to step up. They have for a while.
Well, they can.
Captain Marvel hasn't even come out yet.
No, and that's a directing pair where one of the directors
is a male,
woman,
exactly.
And one is a woman, It's a bit, although they have signed Kate Shortland of the Berlin Syndrome to direct Black Widow. So, but, I mean, that's probably still years away from, and probably years too late to make a difference anyway.
Yeah.
It should have been a Black Widow movie like 3 years ago.
But I love how this director, Lucretia Martel, reacted to it. I thought she did it in a very proper way.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to hearing from her again in the future. We're going to take a break here, and we're going to review Aroma after the break. Because it's December and maybe it's a little chilly out there, we're going to play a little Au Pairs. This is Stay Warm. And they look very comfy here on the cover of their album, wearing these Christmassy sweaters. So we'll come back with a review of Roma after this. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And that was a bit from the trailer for Roma. It is the new film from Alfonso Cuarón. It stars Yalitza Aparicio, Marina Tavira, Veronica Garcia, Nancy Garcia Garcia, Fernando Gredaga, and Jorge Antonio Guerrero. I didn't do too bad with all those.
No,
Latin
that
names.
Was great. Was, yeah.
Yeah, they seems to be rolling a bit freely, the Latin accent. Good for me. Yeah. Anyway, so it's a streaming. It's streaming on Netflix right now, which is, we were talking a bit about this during the music break, that, you know, that the controversy, quote unquote controversy, because this was, might have been in part of Con this year, but because it was bought by Netflix, everything Netflix was banned.
Oh, it might have been a part of Comic-Con?
Con.
Oh, okay.
Con.
C-A, yeah.
It would have been a bold choice for Comic-Con.
Yeah, very interesting choice.
If people thought it was weird when Twilight was at Comic-Con.
Yeah. No, I remember them doing that for Netflix, and I thought that was baloney. I think it was actually us that talked about the streaming. It's like, yeah, I get it. Streaming is different. It might, you know, deteriorate, sit down in cinema, but I personally don't think it will. And I think it's going to make it. What they're doing is the exact same as when you take a taxi and they're dissing the Uber dude the whole time. That's going to make you want to take the Uber more, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah, that's the way I'm viewing it, yeah.
But at the same time, with this movie, I would have liked to have seen it on a big screen.
Yeah, that's true.
I wish they had just, like, this is a special movie, and I think it is a special movie. And I think everyone who has sort of touched this thing or has watched it realizes it's a special movie. And I think that just this once, Netflix, you're squandering $100 million on Friends, which has been around for 25 years. You could, you know, say, okay, we're going to take, you know, we can put, this will be on Netflix eventually, but we could do for a couple of weeks, do a nice wide release, 2,000 screens, encourage people to go out to the cinema to see this. You see it at the cinema, just have the visual feast of this movie.
Yeah,
and then go home and watch it again because it's so great.
Yeah, if you really want to see it, yeah, I'd say seeing it in theaters would be best.
Yeah, but I think probably the closest you can probably is in Toronto. I don't know if it's
at
TIFF.
Yeah, the TIFF theater, you can see it.
Is it at TIFF?
Yeah.
Okay, it's at the TIFF Lightbox. But I mean, still, that's like a sojourn.
Yeah.
If you live in Guelph. Yeah, just to see a movie.
Not playing in Kitchener or anything either. I tried to check.
Right.
So, yeah, I just watched on the Netflix too. I could see why you viewed it in the way you just said. I didn't think it was that great.
Really?
Here's the thing. I just want to quickly say, I love long films like Terrence Malick. I love Slow Burn, like, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson, things like that. So I swear to God, it wasn't just boredom or anything like that. I just don't think it lived up to any of the hype that it got. I agree with what you said. It was beautiful, but I don't think it was more beautiful than other films I've seen. And even the black and white, I thought Nebraska was just as beautiful, right?
Oh,
more
sure.
of the beautiful cinematography shots were of faces and things like that in Nebraska, but I think it was just as special. Whereas in Roma, it was cool shots, but there wasn't enough. I didn't care enough about the characters to care enough about what I was viewing, right? It was a beautiful city, but I didn't care enough about the people living in the city to view those shots in such a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about them later, but there was a few shots in particular that were outstanding. And the best cinematographic shots I have seen in a while.
Mm-hmm. I could see why you would feel that way.
Yeah.
But, the movie is a slow burn, and watching, you know, at the beginning, trying to get like a handle on the style of it, because he does this weird thing, Alfonso Cuarón, I mean, where it's a very personal story. It's based on his life. He said like 90% of it comes from like his memories of what happened.
He was the little blonde boy.
Right.
Yeah. His dad in New Mexico City was a nuclear physicist at the main university. So he was a rich dude.
Yeah, he lived. Yeah, and this is a nice neighborhood in Mexico City.
And he had an indigenous nanny, just like the film.
Right. So it's weird for this like very personal story to be told with like this distance, where everything's sort of in this wide shot.
Yeah.
And he does.
Well, I think the wide shot, because it is from his view, right? As a kid, he's not fully there with her.
But the wide shot is typically not considered like a very intimate or personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
The wide shot is typically like to give you a sense of the place, and then you go in for the close-ups, and that's how you're taught in film school, right? That it immediately gives you like this sense of distance, but for me, as the movie sort of goes on, it sort of pulls you in and pulls you in and pulls you in, even though the perspective never changes.
It gets quicker, it builds up,
right? But you become surprisingly invested in the lives of Cleo in particular, the nanny, and in this family. And it's what I found weird is like it's these like these little vignettes of things. There's a scene where it's so weird because almost like every detail you learn is like overheard as you're watching something else happening. But the whole detail about the father moving out and the mother saying that like he's in Quebec when he's not in Quebec, he's like a few miles away living an entirely different life.
Later she says, she mentioned, it turns out he wasn't in Quebec, but then later she says the exact same thing, but she says Ottawa instead of Quebec. So
right.
Maybe the subtitle had an error, or he just
I think she was a bad liar. I think she's like playing for time, because one of the things you see is that this takes place over months.
Mm-hmm.
So really, dad's doing research in Quebec for a month? No, I don't think he is. But it's her playing for time. And I think it's really good work by the actress who's playing the mom, who's Marina Tavira, that, you know, it makes it pretty explicit without offering a lot of details that she's like struggling herself, trying to hold this together herself and trying to figure out how to tell the kids. And there's this great scene where one of the kids, I think it's the
young
Quran
blondie,
surrogate, overhears her talking on the telephone about dad.
Yeah.
And she comes out and she says, "Were you eavesdropping?" And then slaps
him.
And then immediately goes to hug him. And she goes, like, "Please don't tell your siblings."
Yeah.
And then she turns to Cleo, who's like in there, is like, why did you let him eavesdrop? And I there's just so much of this that it just feels genuine, like that switch up, like from anger to sympathy to anger again.
And yeah, when you go through what she was going through, that sort of thing does happen.
Yeah.
But, like, why was there so much focus on her? Like, it was – I just don't get why it's getting so much acclaim when the main focus isn't even really on Cleo. Like, it's
– Really? I think it's, like, a nonstop on her.
Well, then why is there so much focus? And, like, we just talked about a scene, right?
Right.
That has to do with the rich mom.
Right.
And Cleo has no lines in that part at all. She just,
I know.
Like,
and that, but so I mean, that's the role of the nanny, right? You like see, we see.
I know,
her,
I know.
Right?
That's the point. It's supposed to show, like, yeah, like the nanny, like, is disconnected. Like, that's why it's also more wide shots and things like that. Like, I get that, but like, why? Why do that? Why? Like, what's enjoyable with that? It's for me. It's just it has the style of a film made by a rich kid who didn't talk enough to his nanny to know more about her life.
Hmm.
I don't know. That's just – that's what it felt like to me the whole time.
There's a yin-yang with it that Cleo is like the domestic, but at the same time, she's part of the family. And I find that ping-pong effect very interesting, because there's a scene early on where the dad comes home. First of all, it's hilarious, that scene, him trying to like pull the car into the garage.
All those car scenes, yeah, were hilarious in the shots. Yeah, no, the cinematography at certain parts for me was.
But the whole like trying to get into the car, into the garage is hilarious. Where the dad's like bad-mouthing her, she's like going around putting the kids to bed. And then there's that scene that we just talked about where the Quran kid finds out about the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
But then later on you have after Cleo has her miscarriage, or I guess her baby is born stillborn.
Yeah, it was born stillborn. And then she makes a statement about it that really makes her unlovable. Like,
I don't think it makes her unlovable at all.
Really?
I think that's where a lot of unexpected parents are sometimes.
Yeah, I know. But the post,
But I mean, that scene where they go to the beach, where the mom takes them to the beach and tell them dad's not coming home ever.
Yeah, and then the stupid kids go and they almost drown, and they have her go to save them. And in one of those kids is, it just... To me, I was just thinking the whole time, like, it shows how spoiled Karan was. I don't know, man.
No, I hear you, but I found...
I know that's
But it's
the
all
point.
From the perspective
I know
of
that's the
Cleo,
point,
though.
Too.
She's part of this family, not part of this family.
But she's
still
distant.
Scene,
yeah,
but that scene sort of brings them all together in this.
Yeah, it was a great scene.
And, you know, when they talk about going to the beach and they say, Cleo, you should come with us because, you know, it'll help you feel a bit better. And they're like, yes, Cleo, come. And it's like, oh, she's like.
Mm-hmm. I did enjoy that part. I think the last kind of quarter was parts I enjoyed the most.
Right. And the scene where she can't swim, so she has to go into the ocean to save these two kids.
Yeah.
Who are getting, like, pulled out. I had, like, it must have been because of the wave sounds. But it was like. Saving Private Ryan level of intense for me watching this.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, and it's all done in a long one, like,
see, yeah,
a continuous shot
to me,
too.
But see, yeah, to me that was great.
But you're watching it going, those stupid kids, I hope you
try. No, not the whole time. I swear I wasn't just viewing it as, you know, Karan's family the whole time. I was trying to view it in a very neutral way. I thought that part was cool. Yeah. I don't know. It didn't make me love Karan, or sorry, not Karan, Cleo that much.
Okay.
And I thought that was one of the kind of standout scenes of enjoyment.
It was a standout scene.
Yeah, it was.
Because it's a continuous shot. And, like, there's the sound effect of it. Like, there's no music during the scene. It's
that
just
was
the
another
sound
problem
of the
I had. I don't
there
think...
There was no music?
No, not that there was no music. I just don't think his sounds were that great at all. I don't think... I think without music, you can still go about it in a great way and make it even more enjoyable if you know how to make proper background sounds and how to make footsteps properly sound. And just, you know how to perfectly represent every sound that's needed, even if, you know, it's not, in, even if you don't think it's needed, right?
Right.
And I personally don't think he accomplished that. I thought the first, the 20 minutes, 30 minutes of the water draining down the gutter, I timed it. It was like 5 minutes, so not that long. But no, it just didn't work out. And it just...
But that's great. That, I mean, that, I think you're right about the sound design. but I'm not sure if that he was going
for. It wasn't bad. I just don't think it was special.
But I'm not, I'm not sure that was sort of the aesthetic he was going for. I need to get the perfect set. Like for the water effects, yes, because so much of this is tied to the water. And that the film opens with just looking at the floor and you hear the sound of water going and you don't know what's going on. And then you see the water sort of lap across the floor looking like waves. And then you see Cleo with a mop and bucket. But you don't, like, yeah, she was just cleaning the floor. What you realize later, though, is that this is her cleaning up the dog mess.
Yes.
That, for some reason, these people just, like, let pile up.
That's what I was thinking the whole time. That family lets their dog just poop on cement like that? Yeah. No, you train them to go in the grass or to, you know, in a little bag or
but
whatever.
You see that later on, that you realize that that's what she was doing in the beginning.
It shows how much she's doing for the family. She's
part
of the
family. Then it connects back to, like, this is the scene where it's like, her job is literally about cleaning up the crap.
Yeah.
And then you get the similar feeling back later on when she saves the kids, because it's almost the exact same sound effect with the water going over the pavement.
And she makes the one comment later where she's just having a brief phone call with her friend, and her friend, I think it's her sister. Mm-hmm. Her sister says, you need to go see your mom. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't have time to go see her mom. That's important, because that is an unfortunate, perfect representation of what nannies have to deal with,
right?
In you know, rich neighborhoods, especially.
Sure.
So I get that, but I don't think it was enough for the film to be enjoyable at all. That's one of the only examples I can think of that for me was a perfect representation of what she, as an individual, had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fun. I thought it was fun how it was a view from, you know, a rich kid into her life. And it shows how she doesn't get enough attention. She doesn't get enough focus.
Right.
It shows how interesting and family-like the relationship is.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it does any of that in an enjoyable enough way to make up for the fact that it was based around a little baby Richie Rich's view of view of it. Like, that's, I don't know, it felt like that, too. Were we supposed to like that little blonde kid? He was annoying. He kept, when she was pregnant post the miscarriage, he just kept calling her mute.
Right.
Mute over and over. I get that's supposed to show that nannies have to deal with kids that aren't great,
can
too.
Can we respect the perhaps that Coran recognizes as a kid he was a little dirtbag?
Yeah. I guess, but if you learn from that,
all the kids in the Quran house were SOBs.
But if he perfectly learned that and how to change from that, would he spend millions of dollars making a film about that? Right? Like, I don't know. But also, that kid could not. You know, this could just be slightly based on his life. You know, maybe he was a nicer kid or anything. But no, because I know I've been, you know. Well, I don't want to use the P word, but I've been ooping all over it. And I do want to say Cleo, she was a phenomenal actress. Like, I hope she gets nominated.
Yeah, she's, I mean,
if Oscars, you know, pulls through with the streaming thing.
Right. Yalitza Aparicio, who is herself an indigenous person in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's an actress either. I think this is like her first
one. None of them. Yeah, they're all. See, that was one thing I really did madly respect about it. That and the fact that it was an indigenous nanny. People just kind of think Mexico, there's Mexicans, right?
Yeah.
There's so many different indigenous cultures. And
right.
Especially back in the 70s, you know, like post-40s and things, they got screwed over. They got a lot of land taken, just different things like that. We don't get taught enough about it in Mexico. We don't get taught enough about Mexican culture here in Canada.
Yeah.
So that was good. I liked that little glimpse. That and a lot of the political things that were going on in Mexico in the 70s, which there was a lot of.
Yeah, and that's the scene where they're going furniture shopping for the crib, and the camera pans over to show the riot outside.
Mm-hmm. That was enjoyable.
That was I thought that was a really good scene, because you know it both kind of emblemizes how you know apart some people were from the violence, but also how it was like right there on the street too, and it's a really powerful scene, even though it. I think the thinking for most directors in making that scene would be to, like, take you down into the violence. But no, Caron says, keeps the in the second floor store.
See, I thought that was a success. It's supposed to show, like, that was just so common that, you know,
right.
it's happening back there, but it's not the main part of this movie because it was so common and she just, in real life, would be just kind of walking by.
Right, and you don't go out into it till, like, the aftermath, after, like, the mob has moved on and you see all the people in the streets who are, like, bloodied and dying and... It's a powerful scene for sure.
Mm-hmm. Going off of just the shots, mm-hmm. you know, I there was some great cinematography. I don't think the film was special at all when it comes to that. But
mm-hmm.
One of the early shots was a 4-way dirt road,
mm-hmm.
And the way the camera was angled and it was the full desert made it look like even though the truck turned on the 4-way. Didn't really look like it turned. You know what I mean? It was just a very there's probably a, you know, I'm not a film call. There's probably a specific name for the type of shot it is, but it was really cool.
Uh-huh.
That and the one reoccurring folklore little goblin. There was the one person right. who would dress up as it probably has a specific name, but like I said, a folklore goblin. He would just dance around. And the one scene, there's a huge fire going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody runs out to the fire and, you know, they bring water buckets to push and pour out onto the fire. And then that little monster dude is just kind of dancing around.
Yeah.
And then he comes up right to the camera, takes his mask off and just starts singing.
Yeah.
See, I loved that. That was very artistic. That was very, that could have just been like a short. It was just very, it was beautiful. I was entranced into that.
Yeah.
That I was entranced to, for sure.
I actually forgot about that. But yeah, that's a great scene.
Yeah.
The
film felt surreal even though everything in it was real.
There is a surreal quality to it. Yeah. Like the scene where she's looking at the babies in the nursery and there's an earthquake.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's not done elaborately. Like he doesn't like start shaking the camera. Like it's an earthquake, everybody. But you see the light sway and then you start to see the ceiling fall in and you have the nurses like grabbing the babies, getting them out of the nursery. But then you see this big chunk of ceiling fall on like an incubator.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it had some real qualities to it.
I opinion.
I personally fully see why everybody loved it. And everything I said that was great. I do think it was great. I don't think it was great enough. Okay. A couple visuals that were great. It had a couple mm-hmm. scenes that really did make me care about the main character.
Mm-hmm.
But I, like I said, think it was made from the point of view of a character that kind of ruins the whole point of it being about a nurse, like about the actual real right. life of what a nurse has to deal with. And I know that was partly his point, mm-hmm. that you're not going to be able to learn all of that because they don't have, like, they don't have freedom, right? Like they,
right.
But I don't think he accomplished that. I don't.
One of the things that struck me though is that there are a lot of movies about like domestic people who are, you know, maids or who are nannies. The Hollywood version of that is always like the kid, like the Sound of Music thing. The kids are horrible, but the nanny comes in and is able to show them
this
through song and dance.
A step forward from the help.
And the other thing is that when you see movies are made about domestics, it's usually about them not being domestics mm-hmm. when the movie ends.
Mm-hmm.
It's about them like marrying into a new family or about them, you know, discovering a different life, a different, better life. This is about a woman who starts the movie as a nanny,
mm-hmm.
ends the movie as a nanny. This is her life until the kids grow up.
But just her life through the kids' view. There is not nearly enough scenes of her doing individual things. Like, she did have a family. She did go on dates. And we saw scenes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the point is nannies don't have much time for that. But they could have had a few more scenes of that. They could have had a few more things of, like, also, what did she do? We didn't even get to see her go into her bed and sleep. Maybe his point was trying to say, well, they don't get to sleep much.
Right.
I get it. But I want just a little pinch of a more realistic view into her life as an individual. But that wasn't what Alfonso wanted. So I just want to say he accomplished what he wanted to. And I can fully see why you love it. And 97% of the people that saw it and reviewed it do.
All right. We'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Well, that was our show, and if you like the show, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can listen to all our past episodes there. You can also find us on social media, Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Peter, where can people find you to backlash you over there?
Do it. Send those backlash tweets, man. Mr. Tarrock on Twitter and YouTube. Right. As per usual.
If you want to flatter me with my opinions on Roma, you can find me on Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram. I also write about politics and stuff at GuelphPolitico.ca. And I'll be back here on CFRU tomorrow night at 5 p.m. for Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz there. And that's about politics and stuff. And you should tune in. And that's all I have to say. Anyway, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca. Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we'll be back here next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for the first of our two holiday shows here on End Credits. We will see you then.